Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I'm your host, Sam Lom, and today we're talking with Charters Wynn about his new book, The Moderate Bolshevik, Mikhail Tomsky, From the Factory to the Kremlin, 1880 to 1936. So thank you for being here, Charters, and would you like to tell us a couple of words about yourself?
Yeah, I have been for 32 years a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. My first book was Workers' Strikes and Pogroms, the Donbass Dnieper Bend in Late Imperial Russia, 1870 to 1905. And of course, the Donbass has now been a focus of a lot of interest, and the book has been republished. The future project is entitled The Circle of Five, Stalin's War Cabinet. So I'm turning my focus from labor history, which I've done spent much of my life doing, to now a focus on World War II. That is partly less than, partly because I'm a director of a program focusing on World War II here at the University of Texas.
Okay. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about who Tomsky was and what got you interested in his life?
Yeah. Mikhail Tomsky was the lone proletarian member of the Politburo during the 1920s. So he was from a working class background, rose up through the party ranks, and became a member of the seven-member Politburo of the 1920s. Most of our listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the power struggle that takes place during the 20s. But he was also head of the trade unions, the whole trade union bureaucracy. And I was curious about this man because I was curious about labor history. I was turning to the 1920s, and he appears everywhere, but no one's ever really written about him. It's just he's linked with other names. So I was very intrigued by this worker who would, with only 3 years of elementary school education, could rise into the very top ranks of the party. So that's what intrigued me. And as I learned more and more about him, he was basically involved in every key development during the first 20 years of the Bolshevik Party or of the Soviet Union.
So would you like to tell us a little bit about his personality, how he was perceived by his peers and underlings?
Yeah, he was, he had a very uncharacteristically confident manner. Most of the workers that were in the Bolshevik Party were intimidated by intellectuals, but he never was. So he was also able to charm people, including British trade unionists, people who were opposed to him. He was clearly one of the best orators in the party, kind of a natural public speaker. He spoke in all sorts of settings, but typical of all of these speeches was little insertions in the stenographic reports about laughter in the crowd. So he was witty, charming, self-confident, and he was perceived as really one of the major figures, or even rumors that he would replace Stalin during the 1920s. So that's a little bit about his personality.
So let's start with his early life. Can you tell us a little bit about his upbringing and how his working class and trade unionist background affected his decision to join the party and his views on party matters?
Yeah, so he was born in 1880 in a squalid suburban industrial area outside of the capital city of St. Petersburg. His mother divorced his father before he was born because of his abusive behavior. So he was raised by a single mom, and he really, truly was kind of an example of the kind of impoverishment that existed for so many Russians during this period. As a result, he only had 3 years of formal education before, at the age of 12, he was forced to start working in one of the factories in St. Petersburg. But before too long, he took advantage of the opportunity to become an apprentice, become a printer. So he was one of those skilled workers. And he clearly was always really interested in learning. He was kind of an autodidact. So he's far more worldly than his 3 years of formal education might suggest. The reason he joined the Bolsheviks was he was joining these various circles of the skilled workers were joining, discontented with conditions inside of Russia. And it probably had more to do with the leader of that initial circle, who was a Bolshevik, than any kind of doctrinal differences, which probably made very little sense to Tomsky at this point. But he becomes a Marxist, he becomes a Bolshevik at the age of 24. And that was pretty unusual, too, to join that late, partly because he already had children by this age. So that's a little bit about his background and why he would join the Bolshevik Party.
So what role did Tomsky play in the 1917 revolution?
So he'd been active already by 1905 in the Bolshevik Party. He plays a key role during 1905 in Estonia, where he was, because he was probably blacklisted in St. Petersburg. He then spends 9 years in prison and Siberian exile before 1917 arrives. But once the autocracy collapses, he makes his way back to St. Petersburg, and he plays a leading role during the revolution. And what comes to the fore partly is his willingness to challenge Lenin's ideas. Most initially, because the Bolsheviks in St. Petersburg, Petrograd at this time, wanted to have their own independent newspaper. And Lenin strongly opposed that, but ultimately Tomsky prevailed. Tomsky is also kind of a voice of caution during 1917. He questioned whether or not Russia was really ready for a Bolshevik revolution. He favored a more coalition socialist government. And partly because of his years of in Siberia and in prison before that, and working with the kind of toxic chemicals in the chemical industry, he was often suffered from various physical and increasingly psychological problems. So in the middle of 1917, after the failed July Days uprising, he goes back to Moscow. And it's in Moscow where the most violent events during 1917 take place. But he ultimately, although really determined in this case and in 1905 to do what he could to avoid bloodshed, he ultimately puts aside his reservations and helps usher the Bolsheviks into power in Moscow. So he plays a prominent role in 1917 that's often been obscured by focus on other key figures.
So you describe Tomsky as a moderate Bolshevik. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. People have raised that question before. On the face of it, it seems like an oxymoron, right? Moderate and Bolshevik don't really go together.
I mean, I'm the person who wrote a book on Stalin's constitution, so you know, I find those sorts of things very interesting.
Yeah, well, I think he was just a moderate in the sense that he was far more pragmatic than others, opposed to those who had far more radical ideas about both the possibility of spreading the revolution internationally, but also within Russia. So he was a major defender of NEP, the new economic policy, the moderate or the kind of mixed economy of the 1920s. He was kind of the polar opposite in the party to Trotsky, and they would have a ongoing animosity between the two of them, whereas Trotsky talked about things like we need to create labor armies and we need to militarize labor and we need to shake up the trade unions. Tomsky was someone who was arguing, no, we need to be more in touch with what ordinary workers want, and we need to put aside some of these harsh measures that Trotsky's talking about. So he was moderate in just taking the more, I don't know, prudent, pragmatic, cautious side. And what's probably been lost in the historiography is the sense that there was a real spectrum of views during the 1920s. Again, whereas Trotsky was on one end of that spectrum, often referred to as the leftist end, Tomsky's on the opposite end, a much more rightist position, and or at least that's how it was characterized. Certainly later, when he's denounced as a right deviationist. But yeah, he was moderate in personality and policies. Although, and I know we'll get to this, during the power struggle, he could often sound far from moderate in his willingness to crack down on people who he thought were threatening the policy of NEP, namely Trotsky, and then later Zinoviev and Kamenev as well.
So why don't we transition into that, talk about the role he played in the inner party power struggles in the 20s and his relationships with people like Lenin and Trotsky.
Yeah, well, it goes actually even during the Civil War when Tomsky was in this position of trying to balance between these various roles he was playing, the leader of the trade unions, but also one of the top party officials. And while the party officials really wanted, and Tomsky certainly shared this goal, to have the economy recover, industrialize the economy, Tomsky at the same time wanted to defend workers' interests. So this brought him into conflict with Trotsky during the Civil War, when Trotsky was suggesting these labor armies and other things. During the 1920s, after he's sent out to Siberia, out to Central Asia, and we can come back to that, he's brought back, he's made one of the seven members of the Politburo. So it's just these seven people who were really in charge of making policy in the country. One of the challenges of trying to understand Tomsky's thinking is, why would he support Stalin? But it's important to remember that Stalin was very good at occupying a kind of middle position during the 1920s. He seemed to Tomsky shared many of his Tomsky's moderate goals and ideals. It was Trotsky who really Tomsky saw as the threat to the policies that he shared. I don't think many people have kind of fully appreciated just how that animosity towards Trotsky, not just by Stalin, which has been much played up, but by a person such as Tomsky, would play a role in why he would side with Stalin, along with Bukharin and Rykov, and they had the majority within the Politburo. As everyone knows, ultimately Trotsky is pushed aside. Going back to Lenin, of course, Lenin would be incapacitated in 1922 as a result of the first of his strokes. But Lenin was opposed to putting Tomsky on the Politburo. He was outvoted. Just a kind of an indication of the kind of respect that Tomsky enjoyed, that even over Lenin's objections, he becomes a member of the Politburo. But intertwined with this inner struggle over power within the Politburo was also Tomsky's, continued role as head of the trade unions, and trying to, again, kind of engage in this kind of balancing act between the goals of the party and the goals of the trade unions.
And what exactly were the goals of the trade unions, and how were they different than that of the party?
Well, the goals of the trade unions were to protect workers' interests, allow...
What do you mean by that? Because I'm sure the party would say that they also protected workers' interests. Can you be a little more specific?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically higher wages is what they wanted. The party was saying, no, much more emphasis needs to be pushed on raising productivity. As a result, they would often be in conflict. Tomsky, at the same time, agreed with the party that there should not be strikes, that would undermine these goals of raising production in the country. It's important to appreciate that at the end of the night of the Civil War, the Russian industrial economy had been ultimately virtually completely destroyed. It was some 15% of the productivity levels on the eve of World War I in 1913, and it was only slowly during the 1920s that industrial production got back to where it was, back in 1913. So the goals of the trade unions were to help with improving production, but also to improve conditions for workers, which were also just, completely horrible by the end of the Civil War. So wages would slowly increase during the 1920s. One of the problems for the trade unions that they really had trouble grappling with was the high level of unemployment during the 1920s. But that was not because the number of workers weren't continually increasing, but it was because as the industrial economy begins to recover, all these peasants from rural Russia began flooding into these cities, couldn't find jobs, and the trade unions were not really in a position to do much to alleviate that. But that would be a kind of constant criticism of the trade unions, that they hadn't done more for unemployed young workers, women, and others who were struggling to find jobs during the 1920s.
And so it's this conflict between the goals of the trade unions, which tend to be a little bit more practical and centered on the improving daily conditions of workers' lives, as opposed to the party who's thinking more nationally or globally, that causes the conflict?
Yeah, exactly. The trade unions would try to improve conditions for workers in these individual factories. Also, another big factor during all of this was that the trade unions wanted to have a role in the administration of factories. I mean, one of the goals before the revolution was workers' control. That's what socialism meant, that workers would be in control of industry. But with these various problems and with the lack of kind of administrative skills by many of the workers in these factories, increasingly factories were run by managers who were not workers, who were not and that would be a source of conflict, especially when these so-called bourgeois specialists were brought in at much higher pay, but they actually knew how to run these factories, and in many cases been working for these in managerial positions in these factories before the revolution. So that was another source of real conflict. And Chomsky, and this would be not to his credit, would really support the kind of crackdown on these bourgeois specialists at the end of the 1920s. But they were still, workers had influence. The trade unions had influence. They negotiated these collective agreements in which managers agreed to increase wages. The trade unions, managers could not fire trade unions without, excuse me, could not fire workers without the trade union's approval. They were kind of intimately involved in all sorts of aspects of this recovering industrial economy. And as I said before, by the time you get to 1928, workers' wages have basically gone back to where they were in 1913. Not a particularly impressive accomplishment, perhaps, given that things weren't so wonderful in 1913, but it was a dramatic improvement from what it had been just a few years before.
So you also mentioned that Chomsky plays a huge role in foreign policy in the 1920s through the trade unions. Can you talk a little bit about that and why it was important?
Yeah, so one of the rationalizations for the Bolsheviks, you know, seizing power in this country that didn't meet any of the kind of Marxist preconditions of an advanced industrial country, still overwhelmingly peasant, was that it would spark revolutions in other countries. And they really expected that the Bolshevik Revolution would lead to revolutions in Germany, in France, etc. But it became obvious to Chomsky before others that that really wasn't going to happen anytime soon. And he begins to work towards creating, instead of revolutions in other countries, a kind of international trade union movement that would bring together the trade unions that Chomsky's leading in the Soviet Union with trade unions in other countries. And where he has a really dramatic success, at least initially, is in Great Britain. So one of the few foreign policy achievements of the 1920s for the Soviet Union was the creation of what became known as the Anglo-Russian Committee. This was Chomsky reaching out to Labour Party leaders in Great Britain to create a joint international organization with the goal of having that spread to other countries, namely Germany and France, but other countries as well.
Could you explain why that was possible? Because when, you know, you think of modern Britain, they seem like unlikely bedfellows for the Soviet Union. What made the British working class receptive?
Yeah, it's a good question, especially since the labor leaders were very hostile to the communists and the communist, relatively small communist party inside of Great Britain. I think a lot of it goes back to Chomsky's ability to charm people. So he's brought in as part of this foreign delegation that was working towards having Great Britain finally recognize the Soviet Union as a legitimate government of Great Britain. Of Russia. He is brought to this dinner and he gives this talk, and it's people are just, these labor leaders are all cheering. They're, you brought me back in touch with my goals when I first, joined the Labor Party. Attends numerous conferences where he also gives speeches. At one point, they even throw him up in the air at the end of it. But people describe in very vivid detail just how compelling his presentations were. He also brings many of these labor leaders to the Soviet Union to attend Soviet trade union congresses. So a lot of it is Chomsky's ability to reach common ground with these labor leaders. The problem for Chomsky is he's also having to fight off those within Moscow who don't like this reaching out to these so-called reformists, not radicals in Great Britain. That's part of the story, is him trying to, again, kind of walk this middle line, this kind of balancing act between making appeals to Great Britain, to British labor leaders, while also having to deal with criticisms from many of the leaders of the Bolshevik Party. But his initial success is such that everyone seems to agree that Tomsky has carried off this impressive feat, and that it would be possible to really perhaps create a sort of international trade union movement with social democrats. And without getting into the weeds, there was also inside of Moscow this counter organization known as Profintern, which was to create a communist trade union international. But this was willing to work with social democrats. Tomsky's efforts all come crashing down, though, when there's a 1926 general strike in Great Britain, in which coal miners kind of push the labor leaders into calling this general strike. Their heart's not really into it. They're outmaneuvered by the conservative government, which had been anticipating how they would respond to some sort of strike like this. And after little more than a week, they call off the strike. And for Tomsky to put such faith in these, and had such success with these labor leaders, for them to have betrayed the coal miners and other workers in Great Britain was really used by the more radical members of the party, Trotsky in particular, but Zinoviev and Kamenev, when they would later join up with Trotsky, to kind of undermine Tomsky. But it was initially a success, but it ultimately ends in failure.
When you say conservative British government, you mean the Lloyd George government, right?
No, it's Stanley Baldwin, I think, was just elected. So the Labour Party was only in power for 9 months before. And that goes back to something known as the Zinoviev letter. That, mm-hmm. But part of also why he was successful with these British trade unionists was when the Labour Party is elected, it was against the rules for someone to be in the Labour Party, but also a trade union leader. So many of the trade union leaders who joined...
That makes no sense.
But many of the trade union leaders would leave the trade unions, positions like the president of the Trade Unions Congress, to become a leading figure in the Labour Party. That let more radical workers, because it was the more conservative members of the trade union movement who would join the McDonald's government, and that when that government collapses, many of those people come back into the trade unions. It's they who call off the strike in 1926, and it's not the people with whom Tomsky had such an impressive early success, wining and dining them in Moscow, taking him out to his dacha, grilling shashlik, shish kebab for them. He really developed a friendship with many of them too, who even though things got pretty bitter after the general strike, when Tomsky was under pressure to denounce them, looking towards the end of Tomsky's life, when many of these trade union leaders wanted to reestablish contact with him, Soviet government, the Stalinist government, tried to prevent it, but they ultimately, one of them succeeded. It was partly his ability to join into close collaboration and even friendship with many of these leaders that is, again, a kind of striking example of his charm and self-confidence and pragmatic inclinations. So the more orthodox Marxist ideologues within the party were opposed to this effort to establish close relations with the British trade unionists, but Tomsky went ahead without it. They initially all celebrated his successes, but then jumped at criticizing him when it all comes crashing down after the general strike in 1926.
So did Tomsky speak English?
He did not speak much English, but he, in prison, had tried to learn some English, so he was able to carry on a simple conversation.
Okay.
But in these speeches, there was certainly a translator who was translating them.
Well, I guess the translator did a good job if people found them charismatic, because a bad translator can suck all the fun out of a good speech.
Perhaps you give him more credit, the translator more credit. But like in these other venues, he provoked laughter. He had all these little sayings that people found intriguing. But one of the first times he spoke, Walter Citrin, who was the head of the trade unions in Britain at this point, says, you know, he was on his tiptoes in anticipation, and then Tomsky's metallic voice, you know, filled the room, which seemed all the more surprising to many because he was very short. I mean, he was just 5'3".
All the Bolsheviks are minuscule, though.
That's true. Karin was less than 5 feet tall, I think, and Stalin was relatively tall at 5'6". So.
Well, and Yezhov was an absolute midget, so.
To the British, they seemed, you know, malnourished and had stunted growth. And.
Well, it's because they were. So speaking of Tomsky's other failures, you mentioned that Lenin had him banished to Central Asia. Why did that happen, and how did that affect him?
So in 1920, there was what became known as the trade union debate, or debate over the workers' opposition, who were upset that workers did not have more control. Anyway, Tomsky's initially very successful negotiating that. He even at one of these trade union congresses they vote almost unanimously against Lenin, who's adopted Trotsky's proposal about the need for labor armies and one-man management. This ultimately leads to Tomsky, though, having to compromise, but he plays a leading role in resolving this trade union debate that had become really a topic that everyone in the country or everyone in the party was talking about during 1920. It culminates at the 10th Party Congress, in which workers' opposition is defeated soundly, and Tomsky's compromise proposal carries the day. But just a month after that, at the 4th Trade Union Congress, later in early in 1921, Tomsky kind of regrets having made some of these compromises or is under a lot of pressure from the more radical trade unionists for following Alexander Shlapnikov with the workers' opposition. And he is roundly criticized by the party leaders for allowing this trade union debate to continue. Lenin really wanted it over. I mean, he was very critical of Trotsky for making it public, but once it became public, it had to be resolved. It's also in the context of the Kronstadt revolt, there were strikes and among workers, and Tomsky ultimately is brought before the Politburo and figures in the OGPU, the secret police, the Cheka, and is criticized. Lenin says, was this a mistake or a crime? He can't decide. But in any case, it is the first time that the so-called ban on factions was put into place. Lenin wants Tomsky to be kicked out of the party. Party leadership doesn't go along with that, but he is sent off to Central Asia. On a party mission, he becomes in charge of this Turkestan Commission that was to oversee kind of nationality issues in this area where, even though the civil war is mostly over, there was still a lot of guerrilla warfare by Muslims opposed to the Bolshevik taking over the region. That's how he ends up there. And it really seemed at this point that his political career was over, or at least in the highest echelons of the party. But remarkably, and we could talk a little bit about what happened while he was there. But remarkably, within just 4 months, he's brought back to Moscow. And even more remarkably, again, over Lenin's objections, he's made a member of the seven-member Politburo, the highest policymaking organ in the country. So it is amazing that he would be able to recover so quickly from what seemed like the end of his political career. But he impresses people with how he does things in Central Asia. He comes into serious conflict with one of the real fanatics in the party, who is carrying out a policy of basically of dekulakization here in 1921, not the more familiar one of the end of 1929 and 1930, which he's rounding up these Russian settlers who had moved to Central Asia, in some cases decades earlier, and is basically rounding them up, giving them no time to really prepare, sending them out of these villages, taking them to railroad stations, and these people had no idea of where they were being sent. Tomsky's appalled at this treatment, and here again, he would be this kind of moderate voice. You know, yes, we need to maybe do things about some of these settlers, but to just brutally round them up in this attempt to appeal to the local populations he found appalling, and even more appalling was kind of the treatment of these settlers.
Would you call it dekulakization, or would you call it decolonialization?
Well, it's kind of, yeah, good point. It's basically went hand in hand, and that was partly why this guy Safarov, Georgi Safarov, was advocating these policies. But these settlers were basically kulaks, and that they were more prosperous farmers than the generally nomadic.
Well, kulak is a very squidgy term to begin with.
Yeah, it certainly is. But that's the term that would be used against them. Perhaps Tomsky was too solicitous of them. They had been encouraged back under the czars to move to Central Asia as part of this attempt to have a Russian population in the region.
A slightly racist colonial policy.
Yeah, and yes, definitely. And Tomsky himself had many of these kinds of prejudices against the local population. Yes, that was the justification. Partly was certainly decolonization and an attempt to appeal to the local populations. Also, by this time, Lenin and Trotsky hoped that the revolution, which wasn't spreading to Western Europe, could spread to Asia, and wanted to show Asians that they were serious about decolonization, about supporting, rights of self-determination by the local populations. Tomsky tries to soften the party's policy towards the native population as well. He reopens the mosques, reopens the bazaars, but he is strongly opposed to this policy of just rounding these people off. It's also, of course, in the context of 1920-21, when there's famine across Russia. Where are you going to send these people? He could, as I just suggested, and I say in the book, could be criticized for being overly concerned about their treatment, given that they were these pioneers who came in and took the local population's land, not unlike we're familiar with in the United States, of just moving and pushing out the indigenous population and taking their land. But that had happened well before Tomsky arrives, and the question is, how to deal with this, and he is opposed to just rounding them up and sending them off. Also, partly because there's also a shortage of food inside of Central Asia, and these were farmers who were, providing much of the scant amount of food that there was. Much of Central Asia, was known as Turkestan by the Tsarist government, also by the Soviet, had been converted to cotton farming. So they needed to import grain from Central Europe, Central Russia, as well as the grain that these settlers were providing. But with the railroads cut off during the Civil War, there's a horrible famine, not just in the Volga region that our listeners might be familiar with, but also in Central Asia, where a large percentage of the population would starve to death.
So I'm assuming that this definitely put him in conflict when policies under the five-year plan of industrialization and collectivization and dequalakization came into play. Yes?
Yes. Where Chomsky is most famous, or people have perhaps heard his name, was as part of the so-called right opposition to Stalin's policies, when Stalin suddenly, in 1928, kind of abandons the moderate policies that he had supported and advocated during the 1920s, and begins talking about forced collectivization. Chomsky joins with Bukharin and Rykov, three members of the Politburo, which by this point had expanded to nine members, to try to stop Stalin's policy of dekulakization and forced collectivization. And they predicted the outcome of that would be disastrous. They'd been talking about Stalin in the harshest terms. One of the amazing things is, this is not a novel on my part, but that people would, support Stalin till the day he basically turns against them, and then suddenly the blinders come off, and Bukharin, with Chomsky's support, basically describes Stalin as the next Genghis Khan. He's going to drown the revolution in blood. Yet just 6 months before, they had been working arm in arm with Stalin against the so-called United Opposition. So it is really his opposition to the ending of NEP, to the introduction of these kind of forced collectivization, but also breakneck industrial. The five-year plans, forced collectivization and breakneck industrialization. And he was also concerned that this would also dramatically undercut the power of the trade unions, which it would also lead to a dramatic reduction in workers' wages, which it did. But he also predicted that the peasants would oppose forced collectivization, which they certainly did. And then, of course, it would ultimately lead to the horrible famine of 1932-33. But by this point, he's been pushed out of power. So he basically loses this struggle against Stalin. It was at the 8th Trade Union Congress, December 1928, where this was basically the opposition to Stalin's kind of last organizational base. He's not able to stop the Stalinists from pushing him aside, and he would remain inside the Politburo for a short time afterwards, continue to attend meetings, but he had basically been, had lost all political power. So
how does he spend his time once he's no longer in power? I mean, does he hang out at his dacha like Khrushchev?
Well, he initially basically has a nervous breakdown, is sent off to Germany and Italy for some sort of treatments. I'm not sure exactly what.
Who sent him?
The party.
Wow. So they threw him out of power, but they still sent him on a European spa trip?
Yeah, and you would think maybe after what he just experienced that he would not return. On one of these trips, he's even able to bring his wife, but they return. Bukharin's also sent out of the country to on one of these trips to collect Marxist literature in Germany, but he returns. But after he recovers, and he occupies a few different positions, he's basically head of the chemical industry for a little while. He becomes head of the state publishing operation in Russia.
Glavlit?
Well, it's Agiz.
Okay.
But it's basically the continuation of that. It's got some 36,000 employees. It oversees the publication of everything in Russia during this period. So here's Tomsky, 3 years of formal education, yet he's in charge of the publishing industry in Russia.
That's really not that weird. I mean, I look at, RICOM chairman and stuff all the time. So many of these people have zero qualifications for any of the jobs they have. Sometimes it's too few education. Sometimes it's too much. I got one where it's a professor of history who's in charge suddenly of flax production. And I'm thinking, well, crap, I know nothing about flax. And then other times, yeah, it's someone who did like 2 years of some sort of religious school, and they're supposed to be, managing these huge enterprises. And you're like, oh, God.
Yeah, all true. I mean, certainly, though, Tomsky, by this point, was a very experienced administrator. And the publishing industry was in pretty dire straits. There was a shortage of paper, all sorts of problems. And he was pretty good at refurbishing many of these outdated printing presses, replacing them, getting resources. He even meets with Stalin at one point, pleading for more resources for the publishing industry. But also, though, this is the time when the new policy of socialist realism has come into force. So Tomsky's not really shaping publishing policy so much as administering it. But at one point, they need to get rid of all the textbooks in Russia since things have changed under Stalin. And Tomsky is able to kind of carry out this stupendous publishing expansion of textbooks and other resources. He also would try to help some people who were in dire straits by helping them get published, often anonymously. So there were a few moments of profiles and courage. But basically, during this time, he's administering the trade union issues. He continues to be attacked by the Stalinists. He's brought before basically purge commissions, which also proved to be a great resource because he's basically at these purge commissions. Basically, he's told to tell the story of his life, and he would.
When you're talking purge commissions, you're talking party purge commissions for the renewal of party documents, right?
Yeah, that is the case for many of them, but each enterprise would set up these commissions, and Tomsky's being criticized at the highest levels, at the party congresses, and so these local purge commission, which was, to verify documents, but also to kick people out of the party who, in most cases, was not because of their political views.
Because they were drunk.
Exactly. But they used this opportunity, which is all overseen seen by Kaganovich, to attack Tomsky. And what was kind of striking also in these purge commission, in addition to kind of sharing his life experiences, was that even though these dark clouds were hanging over him, even though he was in political disgrace, the people he was supervising at Ogiz, the publishing conglomerate, would come to his defense and talk about what great improvements he had made in the publishing industry. Sadly, these acts of courage would all mean that not only his former associates in the trade unions, but his associates in the publishing industry would all be rounded up during the Great Purges because of their association.
So he was accused of familyness?
Of what?
Familyness, semeinstvo?
Yeah, he was accused of double dealing. He was accused of basically accused of being an enemy of the people. But these people, it was only after Tomsky commits suicide that these people would all be rounded up. Familiness if you want, but just anyone who basically had close associations with this enemy of the people. And of course, this is familiar with other aspects of the Great Purges.
Well, yeah, I mean, creating family circles and bringing your own people with you and sort of creating a protective family circle is something really common aimed at regional party bosses.
Right. Yeah. No. So, yeah. And it's also clear that he continued to meet with other oppositionists. You know, he was accused of, you know, publicly supporting the party policies, but privately continuing to hold these oppositionist views, would meet with people who'd been opposed to earlier, Zinoviev and Kamenev. Actually, Kamenev becomes employed in the publishing industry as well. So act of almost an entrapment when Tomsky meets with Kamenev over publishing industry issues, and they're accused of collaborating against the party.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, though, is eventually all the leaders have worked together at some point.
And Kamenev later would say, yeah, we talked about everything and anything when we would get together. So,
does he say that before or after the NKVD beats the absolute crap out of him?
Well, yeah, before. It's,
okay.
You know, when they're being terrorized. But yeah, certainly Kamenev and Zinoviev would, you know, were the first targets of the first show trial in Moscow in the summer of 1936, when they would accuse Tomsky of being, you know, a fellow terrorist and, you know, put on the same par as fascists. And it's that which would lead Tomsky to decide that he was not going to go through this process. He was not going to be interrogated. He was not going to have the crap beat out of him, to use your phrase, but he was going to commit suicide instead.
Well, I say that because I'm currently going through repression documents in Kirov, and it's very clear that the NKVD here beat people terribly and did things like the CIA, where they put you in stress postures, where they put you in cold rooms, sleep deprivation, standing for hours on end. Several people end up in psychiatric wards after this. So, yeah, I mean, they did absolutely torture these people.
Yeah, but correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that that's not in 1936. That's more 1937.
That's 1937, but I would imagine that any interrogation documents that Kamenev and Zinoviev gave were probably at least slightly coerced.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's no question about it. And sleep deprivation was a favorite method and very effective. If you really, you don't need to necessarily torture people. But,
well, anybody who's lived through exam week knows it's quite effective.
Right. So, yeah, actually there's a documentary about these people that wanted to get a truck, and if you could hold your hand on the car truck the longest, you would get the truck. And it's this Texas documentary that's kind of fascinating about just how after a couple of days, people, as much as they might want this pickup truck, just could not keep their hand on the truck and start having hallucinations and various other things. So yeah, the so-called conveyor belt of just sleep deprivation, mm-hmm. which this, yeah. Yes, the CIA certainly uses at Guantanamo Bay or used it at Guantanamo Bay.
I think uses.
Yeah, okay. it can be very, very effective. But yes, later they would use harsher methods. But one of the mysteries has always been, you know, why would people confess to crimes they clearly had not committed? Tomsky did not want to go through this process, which he already kind of foresaw, having to provide this last service to the party. He decides to, once he's denounced at this first show trial, kind of the testimony that Zinoviev and Kamenev and others give at the end of the 3 days of hearings, and he picks up the newspaper that his chauffeur has dropped by as he comes to pick him up to take him to another purge hearings. He was also going through purge hearings at the same time as the show trial is going on. He decides, according to his son, to just run along, and he takes a gun. He was a big hunter, as all these party leaders were, but none perhaps as much as Tomsky. And he basically blows his brains out. He hoped, it seems, in his suicide note, would suggest that he was hoping to save his family, but they would, his two older sons would be later arrested and executed. His wife and his youngest son would be sent off to the gulag. So that failed. And he also, as I mentioned, all of these people that had been associated with him would also be swept up in the purges that follow his suicide. And Stalin, the party leadership, is infuriated that he's committed suicide, deprived him of being able to force him through one of these show trials.
Well, I'm sure at that point he doesn't care because he's dead, but... So,
but it's curious that, you know, not a word of sympathy from anybody who had been kind of his friends, that he had been driven to this point, and he committed suicide.
So rather than ending on he committed suicide, why don't we summarize the things that are important about Tomsky that, other than he and Kurt Cobain exited the world the same way, that you would like people to remember about him?
Well, just that he played a central role in all the key developments in early Soviet history, including the stormy debates over the role of unions in the self-proclaimed worker state. That he'd been able to rise from an impoverished working-class background, as we talked about earlier, and years of czarist prison and Siberian exile, to become both a Politburo member and the head of the trade unions. Whereas we've also talked about, he helped shape Soviet domestic and foreign policy along generally moderate lines throughout the 1920s. And it was his opposition to Stalin and his attempt to block Stalin's catastrophic adoption of forced collectivization that would tragically make Tomsky a prime target during the Great Purges. I think that's how I would summarize the significance of this 452-page book, which goes into these various aspects of his life. If your listeners are curious about getting a copy of the book, I'm not sure what Brill's marketing strategy is, but they put out the hardback in very expensive editions. And
they
e-book,
always do.
And the ebook as well. But they also, a year after the publication, which was in March, they will come out through Haymarket Press with a paperback that's very moderately priced. So get your library to order a copy or wait for a year, because right now the book's $190.
Or check out the podcast.
Yeah. Or check out the podcast. There you go.
So thank you very much for being here with us, and I will let you go now.
All right. Thank you.